Hi, let's get going, shall we? Hi, my name's Jos. I'm the Technical Director at Information Leadership. I've been responsible for the development of our SharePoint iWorkplace products since we first released them in 2007. And I've done a lot of the coding. Now, I've been working with SharePoint in one way or another, or the versions of SharePoint, since the 2001 release, though, to be honest, I didn't really get going to the 2003. As you can probably tell, my real passion actually is motorbikes, and this is taken at the Brass Rally a couple of years back. So what I'm going to do first is just spend a few minutes explaining why we have started moving from features and solutions over to using apps instead, and the design approach that we use to do this. I'm then going to do a few coding demos. They are going to be incredibly simple because, you know, trying to do something big and impressive in a short time is going to be hard. And then after that, I'll just discuss some of my thoughts and what we found as we've gone along this path. So one word I will use, and you've probably heard it quite a few other SharePoint things, is the word depreciated. And I want to just be quite clear what this means. You'll find that Microsoft will be saying something's being depreciated. What it actually means is it's still there in the product. It still probably works today. It may not work in the future. And as Microsoft add new functionality into SharePoint, it's likely that it won't work with that new functionality. Now, what you do find as well is some things will not be in the 365 version, but will be on-premise. So as that's going to come up a few times, I thought I'd better make it clear what it actually means. However, there's no problem using things at the moment that are depreciated. So why have we started going down this path now? Well, the first thing is we started having customers coming to us that actually wanted to use 365 rather than do anything on-premise. So they were starting at that point. And so we needed to be able to provide some of our products for them. The second reason was we actually suddenly started getting customers coming to us saying they wanted to use 365, either move completely over to it or to use it in a hybrid situation. And this has been particularly the case since Microsoft started up the data centers in Australia. We also wanted to be a little bit careful. Now, a while back, you may remember Microsoft was saying that 2.16 would be the last on-premise version of SharePoint. They've backed away from that statement a little bit, but it's still, we're using an old technology at the moment for our products. We're using something that's getting frowned on more and more. If any of you have been in Wayne's discussions, you'll have heard him mention that. And so we wanted to make sure we were future-proofing ourselves as much as possible. And what we also found as we went down this path was it's actually a lot easier to develop and support apps than it was with features and solutions. And I'll explain why that is as well later on. So I'm sure you know, you're all aware what happened when solutions and features first appeared. They appeared with SharePoint 2007. There was a lot of noise about them at the time. And they basically gave us access to the full server-side API in SharePoint. Big push at most of the conferences back then. There was a bit of a problem with this in that a lot of people got in their heads that the actual words they used at the time was SharePoint was a development platform. And people almost went into customizing and doing custom development when really they could have done the same thing out of the box. But it did give us a very structured approach to doing customization and deploying this on a server, which was a lot safer than some of the things that had been being done. So the advantages with solutions and features were that you have access to the server and client-side API. You can use both with them. They're well understood now. There's plenty of knowledge base articles, all sorts of information out there, books, websites, information, etc. I mean, if you were doing the SharePoint development back in 2007, you remember that really wasn't the case. There's very little information, but now there's plenty. And of course, with 2016, it's still supported it on-premise, but not with 365. So here are the disadvantages. Again, it's not as supported, it's only for on-premise. You can't use these as they stand, except for the sandbox versions in 365. I often think they're dangerous as well, because if the code is badly written, it can damage your SharePoint system. It can damage the data in, cause performance things, even bring down your farm. And unfortunately, though, as I've mentioned, there are lots of examples and demos and everything else and CodePlex examples on the internet, a lot of them have really badly written code. And we had one customer, for instance, install something they found on CodePlex, said, oh, this will do something for us for free. And it basically brought down their entire farm because of the memory leaks in that code. And that was only 18 months ago, so that stuff's out there. The other thing as well is that you need an outage normally to install any of the changes you are. Now, in most cases, this isn't too much of a problem. We have some customers we work for that, for instance, they have a knowledge base on in an A&E department. There's not a good time to take that SharePoint farm down and install something, even for a couple of minutes, because it's just at that point you can guarantee that someone's going to need that information. We've now finding as well some customers have a very long change cycle. We do have one customer that seems to a rapid change request for them is 3 months. Some of their change requests seem to take about 9 months to push through. So that's becoming more of an issue. And there is also this idea of future. Now, Microsoft, as I say, backed away from this idea that 2016 may be the last on-premise, but certainly where they're putting their development effort into is cloud, it's 365, and it's apps. And it's the client-side object model that they're going to be doing all their development in. They're not really interested in the server side. And you can see that actually from the early, when 2013 first came out to now, how much more has been added to that client-side API. So with 2010, we saw sandbox solutions appear. Now, I think that's really their first attempt at apt, and it was basically a secure wrapper around the customization that limits its impact on SharePoint. So it sounds very familiar to what we had with apps. It was suitable for on-premise and 365s, and you could do installs or upgrades without downing your SharePoint system. So what were the problems? Well, firstly, it was very limiting on what you can actually do with it. If you read the articles at the time, actually, they overplayed that too much, and that basically put us all off. And let's be honest, you know, with 2007, SharePoint and Microsoft have given all the developers great tools to play with and all the rest of it, and now here they are now trying to take most of them away again. So it was never really going to work. So it was depreciated with SharePoint 2013, but sandbox solutions are still available in 2016, and maybe an old occasion where they could come in useful. So with SharePoint 2013, we saw the release of apps. And as I mentioned at first, it's just based on the client object model, and there were still quite a few restrictions on what you could do. But I've just noticed in the last couple of years how that client object model things have been added, extra functionality, lots of extra examples, which we'll get onto shortly, and has made that far more worthwhile. And that's one of the reasons why we've started moving over to it. Obviously, they were initially targeted at 365, but there's no reason why you can't use them on-premise as well. Obviously, if you're doing 365, either dedicated or hybrid, you really only have one option here, which is the apps model. You could go sandbox, but we're not quite sure where that's heading. I suspect eventually the functionality that's there that can't be done at the moment in apps is going to end up in apps. So if you're doing any new development or redesigning a product, that's really the only way to go. So let's cover off a little bit of what apps actually are. There's two models available. The first one is SharePoint hosted. And as its name suggests, all the files are held within SharePoint. And it's basically anything you can do in a browser. So you're limited to JavaScript and HTML and things like that. You can't have certain things. You can't have a custom page in there or anything like that. But all the code is wrapped into SharePoint. Oops, got one too many there. So as I mentioned, it only has the client API available. You can't do any server-side code, but it is suitable on-premise and the cloud. You're restricted on what programming languages you can use. Really, you're limited to JavaScript, HTML, etc. And there is another issue with this as well. It's in the browser, so timeouts may become an issue if you start doing anything too complex. It's limited scope, and what I mean by that is that updates are painful to do. If you make a change to one of your SharePoint apps, the users have got to go in and they've got to say, oh yes, I trust this, or I want to do this upgrade, and they've got to do it in all their sites. So it's a real pain to roll out those updates. Surprisingly so, considering, you know, what it's supposed to be, make things easier. And the other problem I would say with it is there's not an easy way to remotely access data. A lot of our solutions around getting data from other site collections, breaking down that barrier between site collections or even other systems. You can do it, but again, it's difficult to do, and timeouts often become an issue as well. So if you're thinking of doing this sort of app, think of it for point solutions. If you've got a need for a custom web part in one site, then this type of app may be sufficient for what you want to do. But otherwise, if you're doing something that's going to go in 20, 30, 50 sites or going to go to a lot of different customers, it may not be. So the second type of app is provider-hosted. And this is where what I call the app stub lives in SharePoint. Now that app stub is really just a SharePoint-hosted app. So you can do all the things with that you could do with the SharePoint app if you wanted to. However, the majority of the code lives somewhere else. It normally lives in Azure, but it could also live on a server in a data farm or a data center or even an on-premise server if you wanted to. You connect from your SharePoint system using OAuth authentication, so it's a secure connection going backwards and forwards between the two. You've still only got the client API available, but as far as developers are concerned, you've got the full range of development tools there, and actually a lot more than you would with a standard SharePoint implementation. So just going through this again, I've got the client-side API available to us. It's on-premise and cloud. It's provider-hosted and browser-hosted, so we've got this kind of equivalent of server-side code there. We can use C#, we can do all the things, you can even write things in a completely new programming language, or let's go back to COBOL or something like that if you're really desperate. But it needs a dedicated server or site in your remote system like Azure that it connects to, does the processing, and then brings the results back to SharePoint. It's external to SharePoint. So what this means is that I can do an update on my Azure server and all my customers get that straight away. Now, of course, that has a downside to it. You've got to make sure what you're putting on that server is good and is going to work and is not going to knock out all your customers in one go. But I'm not going to worry about arranging an update, putting a change request on my SharePoint system, and then if something goes wrong, taking another 3 months to pull it back again. The other advantage with this is a lot easier to get to other data, not only in other site collections, but I can do things like I can have a hybrid system with on-premise and 365 and perhaps be showing documents, a list of documents that are in my on-premise system in my 365 sites and all the rest of it. And obviously go off and access other data spaces and line of business systems as well. So I'm just going to quickly go through the approach that we use to make some decisions here. And what we decided was we'd identify the things that all our products shared and what we needed to solve with this to see whether apps were actually going to do the job. And the first one of those was consistent styling. So we wanted it so when the user went from within the SharePoint to our app that they would see, it would continue to look like SharePoint. We wanted to include the standard functionality. We wanted pages, we wanted buttons, we wanted menus. Again, we wanted it to look like SharePoint pages, buttons, and menus. We wanted, one of the main things is we wanted to be able to go into different site collections. As I said, most of our products resolve around that, getting information from this and other places and presenting it to a user wherever they work. And this could also be off to other databases and systems as well. Another part of this is storing settings. Sounds quite obvious, but we wanted to be able to users to configure things, set up where they're getting information from, how they want it to look, and it to save the settings so the next time they go in, that's what they're seeing. One of the main things we needed was bulk access to data. Now, for instance, if I take our record manager system, what that does is actually index the entire SharePoint system and allow users to make big bulk updates, maybe archiving 5,000 documents or updating the metadata on 10,000. So that was particularly important to us. And the other thing, of course, is we have multiple customers. So anything we did had to work with all those customers, and we knew we weren't going to cause problems when it did. So SharePoint hosted. We had concerns and thought this wasn't really going to be suitable for us from what we'd read, but we decided, no, we needed to test this ourselves. So what we did was take one of our products and actually redevelop it used as a SharePoint hosted app, and in this case it was our FlexiViewer product. And we did actually get it all working, but we found some issues with it. So styling, absolutely fine. Picks up the SharePoint styles. It's running really in SharePoint, so that wasn't an issue at all. We did find problems with some of the functionality. There are things that we couldn't do. For instance, one of the things was we couldn't put custom pages in there easily. There were problems with going, as I mentioned, between going to other site collections, getting data from other locations. Some things we could do, some things we couldn't. Again, with storing settings, we could just about get things into property bags, but we found that there were restrictions around the security on what we could actually do. Bulk access of data was a no-no, and that's purely down to timeouts, because you're trying to do it within a browser app, within code that's running within the browser. It's going to run out of steam at some point and you're going to hit problems. But multiple customers was fine because it's something that runs within each site, within that browser. So it's almost limited right down to the individual user. So then we did the same thing with provider hosted. We started with the same product and tried implementing it. And what we found is virtually everything in there we could do with apps. Now, with some of the page stuff and some of the standard functionality, we couldn't do it in the same way as we did with solutions and features, but there was always an alternative route to get to the same place. And the same was true with the bulk access of data. And in fact, in some ways, it opened up new options for us. And one of them I mentioned was that it was very easy, as long as the users got their single sign-on between their on-premise and their 365, we could easily link between those two systems and make it look like it was just one. So what I'm going to do now is just going to do a very simple demo of some code, and it is incredibly simple. But before I start, I'd like to mention about the patterns and practices. So I'm sure you've heard this mentioned in numerous sessions already, but it really is a very good source of how to do things with apps in SharePoint. It's constantly evolving. There's stuff in there that I was talking to with Wayne about 6 months ago, saying, how do you do this? I can't work this out. And the next thing I knew, there was something appearing in patterns and practices telling me exactly how to do what I wanted to do. So a very, very good resource. What we're going to actually do here is we're just going to create a provider hosted app very quickly, or flesh one out a little bit, and it will be full immersion. So there's two ways that apps run within SharePoint. There's full immersion and an app part, which is similar to web part. So what I'll quickly do now is just go through and actually show that. Okay, so here I am in one of our demo sites, and I'm just going to go into a document library. And at the top there, we've added something into the ribbon, which is from template. Now, this is for one of our products. It's something that's been around since 2007. It's just an easy way for customers to create templates from within libraries. And so we've put it in the ribbon there, and when the user clicks on that, now this little bit is being done. Remember I mentioned that app stub? The bit to put this thing in the ribbon is done in the app stub code. And this is what's going to call our Azure site when the user clicks on it. Now watch the URL at the top of the page as I click on that. Because what you'll see, it go from being SharePoint to a completely different URL. And what's actually happened there is I've now gone over to my Azure site. But as far as my customer is concerned, this is all part of the same SharePoint experience. I'm just going to go through, I'll just quickly choose a template and things like that. And what happens now, I'm taken back to SharePoint. So it's a smooth transition for a user. Though they're going into somewhere completely different, they think that they're doing one thing. And finally, this happens to go off to Word now. It lets the customer set the metadata, and then it just bangs into Word to allow them to edit it. So if I go to contracts instead, I can actually show you what a web app looks like. And it's quite simple. This is an early beta version of our FlexiViewer one. It just looks like a web part to a customer. But in this particular case, this is another Azure application. Behind the scenes, this is going off to Azure, getting my code, running my code, then coming back and presenting the results in the page. You can almost think of it like an iframe, but that's a slightly different way to do that to make sure that it will resize. If the content resizes, it resizes on the page and looks seamless to the users. Very good examples on that as well in patterns and practices. Okay, so what we'll do now is we're just going to do a very simple application. It's going to be incredibly simple. But first one I want to show you is this is it. When you create create a solution, here's your two sections within the project. And the top bit's the app stub that I keep mentioning. And the bottom bit is all the code that we loaded into your web server. Now, you've got to be really careful what you put in that app stub. If you copy something in like a new image file or decide to put a page in there, it will stop being that app stub and turn into a solution with a feature file. So it's no longer a proper app anymore. So just be very careful. And I mean, what I do with this, to be honest, is keep a backup of it in case I accidentally put something in there I shouldn't have done. The best bet is to almost leave it alone. And the only thing I really put in there is things like that, an element file to put the item in the ribbon or into a menu somewhere. Okay, what we're going to do first is I'm going to show you how an app looks at first without any styling applied. So we're just going to stick some text in here. And I'm going to run this, and it's going to run it as a full immersion app. And it's asking me, because this is the first time I've done it, do I actually trust this app? Because it's never seen it before. And here we go, something really awful. So it's just displaying the text I put in. There's no sense of place here. It could be any web page anywhere. What I'm going to do now is steal some of the code from Patterns and Practices. There's a really good demo there. I'll just uncomment out my stuff on here. That allows you to apply branding. So it will take the branding and styling from SharePoint and put it into your app. Now, of course, this has huge advantages if, like us, you're dealing with multiple customers or even multiple sites within your organization with different branding, because what it will do is pick that branding from here. Now, it does do something slightly crazy in that it injects code into the page as the page runs. Because what actually happens is that branding is applied as the page loads. But what we'll see here, and one other thing I have to do as well, is just update the permissions, because this app now needs to have read access to that website so that it can actually read the styling from it and that branding. So we'll run that. Again, it's asking me to trust it, and the reason for this is because I've made a change to the security. What you'll see is initially the styling looks like it did before, but now it's actually then pulled in the styles, the colours from SharePoint and applied them to my app. So it's very easy to do this. Okay, I'm now going to do a very, very simple, I told you it was a simple coding example. We're going to do 3 lines of code, and if any developer working for me did something like this, I'd be very annoyed with them. But we're going to do something here where it connects to a news list in my site, gets the first item in the news list, gets the title out and sticks it in a label. And I just want to show you how you would do this with the client API instead. So here's my news list, and to make life a little easier, I've put in the title of it, I've put first item and last item, because we're going to play around with that later. And I'll go back to my app and I'll just put in the code for this. The first thing I'm going to do is put a reference to the client-side DLL. Now, because I've been doing SharePoint development for a while, I tend to use the SP equals so that everything like my list object, my site object begin with SP. And to me, that just makes sense, but that's purely a personal preference. So here we go. I'm going to define a SharePoint list. And this is going to connect to my news list. So here with SharePoint, we do everything within this client context. And what I'm doing is overriding the code that was already there. So the original code that comes with the standard project just puts in a title on the, takes the title off the site and displays it on a page. What I'm doing is expanding this a bit, or changing this now to do what I want to do, which is get my news list in, find the first item, and then update a label field. Now, what you have to do, because this is client-side, you're connected as the user, this connects as the user, and you have to do this thing where you load. So you can have a certain amount of code, but at some point you have to connect back to SharePoint and say, give me what I've requested, give me something to work on before you move on to the next stage. So what I've done here is I'm doing this load to get the list item in, and that way I'm able to get the title and also the body of my item as well. So if I run this now, and again we'll see that slight changing. The reason that's so slow on the starting is because of it's obviously running on my local machine connecting up to as I'm in dev environment. But there you can see that first news article has been pulled down. It's got the first item, it's displaying it. And working almost the same way as you would on the server side. So let's change this a little bit and say, I want the last item. It makes more sense to have the last news item, not the very first one. I want to see what the latest news is. So I've cheated a bit here. I've grabbed some camel code I've written earlier. And what this does is just simply go off, get the last news article, and come back. So just like you would with normal on-premise SharePoint, you start using camel queries to get your data. Most efficient way, you can limit it to only come back with the fields. In fact, that's a really important thing to do. Just tell it the fields that you want to come back with, in this case, the title and the body field, because that helps cut down what you bring back. You've also got the row limit here. Now, the format to these is ever so slightly different for if you've done camel queries in the past, because everything goes into the view construct, so you're doing the whole lot. So what I'm going to do now is just change this to give me that last item that returns. It's returned by that camel query. And we'll run this, and I'm expecting something to go wrong. I'll explain why in a moment. Okay, so what I've got is an error, and the reason for that is because this items, this result from the query, doesn't exist yet. I haven't done the call to SharePoint to get those items, so therefore I can't go and get the item from the items, from that query results. And you'll find this a lot. You have to put these calls to go back to SharePoint, give you something more to process, do some processing, and then do another call to SharePoint. So to fix that, I just put in another client load to load in my items to do that call back to SharePoint. You'll find you'll get quite a few of these in your code once you start doing a lot of it. And this should run, and this should bring me back the last item in the list. However, what I've actually written there is very inefficient, as I'll show you shortly. So we'll just prove that that did actually work. There we are, last item. But what I can actually do is remove this call, because if I'm loading all the item results of my query and I've defined what data to come back with, I don't actually have to then do another call to SharePoint to bring the item back. And what you see on the internet with some of the examples is that I'll have loads of these calls in, and a lot of them are not required. And it's very inefficient because you're doing a call, you're waiting for SharePoint to respond, it sends it back to Azure. You've also then got more chance of things like throttling and stuff cutting in. So another common scenario with SharePoint, one we use a lot, is the need to go off to another site collection and get data from there. And also often to run as a service account, to run as a web app account, because the user may not have access directly to something. So an example of that may be a CEO's blog site. She's putting information in there, and you want to return the data and show it on your page, but they do that in their own little secure area. But so you need to do a call as the service account, get the latest news item back, display it on the page. You can do exactly the same as this is doing on server side with the client side code, and that's thanks to something called the token helper file. Now this is something that comes in the SharePoint project, and it's code that Microsoft have written to just allow you to do that. Now what I'm going to do first is I'm going to add a user field here so that you can actually see what user I'm connecting up as, just to prove that it's doing it. And again, because I'm pulling in something new, I've got to do my load again. There we go, so we'll just run this. Oh, yes, I've got the updated name as well. What you find with this token helper file is that it's fine for one instance. If you're just using it and you're installing it one instance in Azure, it'll work absolutely fine. If you actually want to start doing stuff, and there you can see it's actually showing my username at the moment as I run this, so you know we're connecting as me. So what we'll do now is we'll alter this code so that it uses this token helper file to connect as a service account. This is very similar to the web app account. It's actually called app service, but it's similar to the web app account you used to do the elevation in SharePoint. So I'm going to put in my URL. In this particular case, I'm going to put in the one that I'm already using. I'm going to go to the same site, but obviously it could go to any site. And it can go, as long as your security works okay, it could actually go to a site in another on another system, another 365 or even on-premise system. And here I'm using this app class, so I'm saying thing. There's one other change I have to do. I have to tick this box to say, allow this app to make calls into SharePoint as itself, not as the user. And if you don't tick that, it won't run. It won't work, and you'll get a security error. And it's a very strange security error that makes no sense as well, I'll warn you now. So like with a lot of SharePoint. Again, because I've changed security, I have to trust it. And there we go. We've got the. You can see that it's using this app at SharePoint account. So that was a very simple demo of some coding. But hopefully you see how the sort of things that you're used to using, maybe in your apps, they're all still there. They're just ever so slightly different way of doing things. Okay, so going on to storing settings within our apps. Now, if you've done server-side development, there's two places you've probably saved settings for. One is in the app, the web part settings at the side. So if you design custom web parts, you've probably got an area there where you have all the special settings for users. There's a couple of ways of implementing that, but generally they work the same. If you're doing other things, the normal place to say you've got something that goes off that's using a page, you're probably using the property bags, either at that site level, within the site collection, or even at the top level site collection for the whole web application. Standard way of things, people have been doing stuff. One other approach you may have used is actually just having a list where you save the settings in. I mean, that's good for tabular data, but obviously not so good for performance. So, with our system, what we've done is we started off using the thing, because with app parts, you can do the same thing. You can put your settings down in the side. However, we quickly found a problem with that, in that if you make one change, we say, oh, when someone asks for a new tick box on this, what happens then is that you have to redeploy that app. You know how to go through the trust, or I have to tell all the users it's an upgrade. I have to click in all my sites to say it's an upgrade. So what we've done instead is that we've used a page. It picks up when you've got your web part being displayed. It picks up that someone's gone in to edit that web part. It changes the page from my Azure site that's being displayed within that web app to a settings page instead. And it lets my users define everything in there. And that means when I do an update and add a new setting, I only have to do it within the Azure site. I can leave everything alone inside SharePoint. The same thing, the full immersion apps are even simpler. All you've got to have is a page there for saving things, so putting the information in. And that's what we've done, say, with Template Central. So the user just goes into the settings page, and we've did it with this particular one, is that you get the apps being installed under your site contents, and when you click on that, it takes you to the settings page for that particular level. So where do we store these settings? Now, we could poke the data back into property bags, for example, within SharePoint. But the problem with that is you've then got this, SharePoint's going to Azure, you're then going back from Azure to SharePoint to get the settings, you're going back, and you've got a lot more backwards and forwards traffic. So what we've tended to use is the Azure Document DB service instead to save the settings. So you could save them in SQL database in Azure. There's several places to store them, but this one we found very useful. The reason for that is that it can store JSON data, so there's no need for a predefined schema. You know, if we decide to add a new setting or we want to store the settings of several different of our apps in one place, they can all be stored in here. Because it's JSON as well, and the way this document DB is done, it's all indexed. It's incredibly quick to get results. And of course, we can pass those, we can duplicate those document sets across multiple data centers and things like that. So a customer can log in anywhere in the world and they'll get the settings to do with them. And I'll come on to that shortly. The other advantage for us is you can actually connect to it very easily from either C# code, your JavaScript. It's using standard queries. They're just like select statements, as if you're connecting to a database. So, bulk data access. That was the big thing for us, as I mentioned, with some of our products. We do a lot of bulk reading of information, and as I said as well, there's some that also do bulk updates as well. Our document management thing called a records manager not only provides views of all the libraries, so for instance we allow people to say all the documents in the system that have a certain value in the metadata or whatever, but it also allows users to run updates across all those documents. So it is very intense on the way it does things. So there were three things we found in SharePoint we could use to iterate. So most of this is taken from the point of indexing the sites or going through and finding all the information. But it could be that you want to do something like update the value of a certain column in all the sites or add a new column to a library. And this would be the standard way to do it. You connect to your site collection, you connect to your site, you get to your lists, to your folders, to your item, and so on and so forth. Now the advantage with this, the data is always up to date, it's always at the time you're connecting. But obviously there's a heavy transaction load on SharePoint. You may be getting a lot of objects like the site, the web, you don't really need, you're only interested in one particular item within SharePoint. And so that can also then come on to one other cause that problem that could cause shortly. So the other API we've used quite a few times is the search API. This is really handy if you want to get items in the example I've given here where a case number equals something, or there's something that you want to say and want to get all the items back. Very fast, very efficient. It's also good because you can actually look at the content of documents as well, so you're not just limited by the metadata. But of course, the problem with it is only as good as the last time the index was run. And with 365, you have no control over when the indexes run. Now, it should run very regularly, but for instance, we had a customer where they were getting sometimes up to 2 days before their index was updated. So just be aware of that. It only retrieves the items, though. So, of course, if you actually want to do updates then afterwards, you've still got to drill down. You've got to use your iteration to connect back. The other thing we've used occasionally, not very often, is the change log. There's an API for this. And this is really like what's changed in this site or this site collection or this library since a certain point of time. Now, it's always up to date because it's right to the moment when you do the check. But the problem with SharePoint only keeps that data for a certain length of time. You can adjust how long a bit, but you obviously don't want it growing too large because it can get massive on a high traffic site. It's very good for those things, though, where maybe you're pulling the information off and putting it in the index. So you're then only updating in your index or your database or whatever the items that have changed in that time. It's no good, of course, for general queries. I can't say how many items with such a case number or anything like that. But this is one we've used a bit, as I've mentioned. Right, so what's the one problem with all of these and anything that you do with SharePoint 365, or indeed SharePoint nowadays, is throttling. Now, possible causes are for throttling are repeated actions, something that you're doing. I want to update the following column in 1,000 items, would be another thing, a bulk updates, or anything that looks like load testing. So if you're going through all your sites and libraries and everything, it's quite likely that one of the rules will say, this looks like someone's trying to load test our system, we're going to start throttling this back. Of course, it's not just development that can cause these sort of problems, but on most of the times it is development code. In theory, a user can do this as well, but I've never actually seen a user do anything that's caused throttling to kick in. There's no definite definition of what will be throttled, but what Microsoft are obviously trying to do here is stop what you're doing on your 365 system impacting on another customer. One of the main things here, beware administrators and PowerShell, because they love writing little scripts to go off and do something and go through everything on the system, and that's almost certainly going to get throttled. So it's not just development. So throttling, there's no published information about what the rules were. There was a bit of guidance at one point, but that's been removed. And there's a really good reason for that, because we'd all code round it if we knew what the rules were. It's quite simple. However, there is an excellent Microsoft article on here that I've referred to several times. It's got examples about what you can do to avoid this, how throttling works and everything else. Really good kickoff point. It links into the projects in the patterns and practices that will help you get around throttling as well. And it's almost always code. As I mentioned, it's very seldom that the user actionable thing. It's code or PowerShell that's likely to cause the problem. So throttling's a two-way stage process. If you run something like an update of 1,000 items, the first thing you'll start getting back is these 429 errors, which says too many requests, you're doing too much. And if you start getting those, you can continue to try, but you'll get bounced back. You'll get more and more of these messages come back, and it will stop the process, and you'll have to resubmit what you've just sent. If you ignore this in your code and keep on pressing ahead regardless, then you get a 503 error. A service is unavailable. And basically, from that point on, your process will not be able to run against SharePoint. And the only way you can fix this one is actually sorting out your process so it's not going to cause the problem any further, and then are kindly asking Microsoft if they will release it and let it run again. So this is a biggie. You never want to get to that point. So how do you avoid it? Well, I mentioned in that article and in the patterns and practices, they've implemented this execute query with incremental retry. Does exactly what it sounds like it does. It tries to do something. If it gets a 429 error back, it will stop, wait however many seconds you say, in this example 30 seconds, and then it will retry it again. So it's a way to add a gap in, and the whole idea is to stop that throttling getting any worse. However, my feeling is a little bit that you shouldn't be even getting to this point. You shouldn't be relying on. This is the kind of last stop, if you like, when you're doing your queries. Where possible, you should be caching your data. So with the FlexiViewer product I showed you earlier, the first user that goes in, it loads in the information for them and puts it into a cache, this cache in Azure. And that's what's presenting to users. And all we do is when a new user hits that web part, goes off, checks the cache, has anything changed in the list, or has the list been updated and you've got a date stamp on the list? No, okay, I'll show them the cache data. If it has been, what it actually does is show the cache data and then in the background pulls in the updates to that cache data. So try and use caching where possible. Move your data outside SharePoint. Cut down on those calls. And the other thing is, and something that worked for us, is to make the actions irregular. And what I mean by that is try and make what you're doing look like a user's doing it, not a system process. Now, we've used this with the indexing. So I was mentioning the Record Manager's product goes through and indexes every site, library, document in a system, which could be a real problem with throttling. But the way we've written the code, we've put in random delays in all over the place, so this doesn't look regular. And we try doing it so it's not going from site to site, site, library, 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 item, 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 going through like that, but rather going in sort of a slightly random way. We've managed to index sites with 100 site collections. I think it was 10 libraries in each with 5,000 documents in each of those libraries without any problems at all. So there are ways around this without any problems. The other thing is that normal throttling things, the things that we're all used to already in SharePoint, still apply as well. So if you're going to get items from a list and it's a big list or a big document library, you still need to do those settings and reduce the number of items to say 5,000 and batch through them in that way. And the code is almost identical to what hopefully you've already been doing on the on-premise stuff. One thing I will mention, if anyone's been dealing with really big document libraries and they found that on-premise, the 5,000 limit even throttles out after maybe going through, if you're 80,000 on a in our particular case, we found hit about 80,000 items and it still has a problem with throttling. You don't get that problem with the client-side object model. So the final thing I just want to quickly cover is multiple customers. So obviously with Azure, if you're running in Azure, you have the option. So if you have one customer, you can perhaps have it set up with your application with one core, one instance. As you add more customers or as the load increases, you can add more cores. So it's not like a traditional app where you have to build everything initially from start. You can also set schedules so things increase and decrease as required or as the load increases. There's one other thing that we found really useful with Azure. So for instance, with our New Zealand customers, we're connecting them through to the data center in Australia to connect to a particular app. And there, from there, they're connecting to document DSQL, etc. What we then had is a customer from Singapore join in. And, you know, obviously, they could connect to our application within or in Australia. But that doesn't make a lot of sense because there's a data center in Singapore. So why shouldn't they use that instead? So that's fine. We could create another instance of our app in the Singapore. But then you've got two URLs. You've got one for the people in Singapore and one for the people in New Zealand. What you have in Azure is this idea of a traffic manager. And what that does is give one URL out to the world about where you connect. And then it works out where their local data center is, where their local instance of your app is. And it will route them through automatically to that, rather than having to go somewhere else. And one of the advantages with that as well is if, for example, Australia decided to cut all New Zealand access because we've beaten them yet again in the World Cup, then it would all New Zealand customers would go via Singapore instead. So the stability is there as well, if you like, or that pleases some people as well. So what have I found from the process? Well, the first thing was the dev barriers were a vaporware. They didn't actually exist. There are some things, no, you can't do in the same way as a solution and a feature. But there always is a way around it, and often it's a better way. For instance, with our Template Central product, I demoed that to a customer earlier this week at the SharePoint conference because I was asking about what's it look like in 365. And some of the things that I'd had to change to adapt it for 365, they actually preferred to the original version. So it's not a block at all. And when you go through, there's very little that you can't do. You find better ways of doing things. And of course, you have got this access to all these extra tools as well. The throttling I mentioned isn't a problem. There are ways around it. It's the big worry that a lot of people have because they've heard about it. It's panic mode, but it's not a problem. Just be a little bit careful, put those safeties in place, and you don't have a problem. And as I mentioned with Record Manager, I think we sort of prove that in what we do with it. The other thing is customers are ready for this. They are ready for 365. They're asking about it. They want to move it. They've already worked out that apps are a safer way to go because it's not going to damage their SHARM. You can do updates. They've got used to this idea of continuous updates. We've noticed a real change in the last 18 months about the number of people coming to us about 365 implementations. It frees the developer. So what I mean by that, I've suddenly got all these extra tools and things I can play with in Azure. I've got caches, I've got places to store things. I can use different programming languages. So one of my developers gone off and one of the web parts he's done, he's used a completely different way of doing things from what anything else we've done. It doesn't matter. As long as we can support it, it doesn't matter. So that's one thing I've found with this, which I was surprised at. And I like the idea that I can also do updates on it without having to go through the whole rigmarole. So I can keep my customers up to date, can keep introducing new functionality as we go along. So our plan at the moment is we're going to get all our products over to apps. We're going to offer them still as solutions for on-premise, but then also using Azure and using the cloud. What we're going to then offer is a solution where the solution just becomes a stub, rather like an app stub, and behind the scenes, it can either be connecting to Azure or an on-premise server if a customer prefers. So this means we can start. So at the moment, we've got two code sets. We've got our on-premise, old solutions and features, and we've got our stuff that we're doing for the cloud. But our whole plan is to get rid of all that code, have one base of code, and just have either the solutions and features connecting to that or the app itself. And that's quite exciting for us because it means we've got a very easy migration path for our customers. Obviously, eventually, I'd like to get rid of the on-premise stuff because it makes my life even easier, but I accept that it's going to be around for a while. Okay, the last bit's questions. Now, there is one small problem with that. I'm deaf, so I have trouble hearing people, so often I end up answering completely the wrong question. So what I've also done as well is created a little Yammer group, which you can just normally ignite, but then when 377, you can ask me questions. We'll keep it going for about a week or so afterwards. Want to know or code examples and things like that. I'll also be around here or around where the food is or whatever the rest of the day as well, so welcome to track me down. Yeah, I can hear you. You can have a go at asking me a question now. It just may not give the right answer. So any questions? I'll put you all off now, haven't I, saying that? Okay, well, in that case, make a run for lunch, I think, probably.